Accession number 28750, Reel 18.
Laurie Manton, Reel 18. Yes, you've been talking about the IRA, Laurie. Did you have any experience of the nationalists, you know, and what was happening with some of their groups?
Yeah, the nationalists, or unionists that some people called them, it was very strange because when you went round, for example, the estates in Belfast, if it was a Republican area, then you'd have the Irish tricolour flying everywhere. But if you went to a nationalist area, then the curbstones would be painted red, white and blue alternatively, like the Union Jack. And you knew by the colour of the curbstones on the main roads what sort of area you were in, which is very odd. And of course they put like a equivalent of a Berlin Wall between the two communities, which was very, very strange to see. But on the unionist side, they used to have these fantastic murals on the end of houses, which I always used to enjoy photographing because they were real works of art. And in the Republican areas, they had their own murals. I'm sure they competed with each other. And so it was like going through an art gallery when you were going around Belfast. It was utterly fantastic. But I think the unionist trouble side, the Ulster Volunteer Force, the UDA was another one, and these loyalist organisations, they were killing Republicans quite out of hand. Oh, let's go off and kill so-and-so and so-and-so. Oh, there's a postman. He lives in a Republican area. Next time he comes round next morning to do the post, let's shoot him dead. Or you might have a factory in a unionist area where one of the workers was known to be Catholic and the rest were Protestant. And odds on, gunmen from the unionist side would come in, identify the one Catholic, shoot him dead in front of all the Protestants and go. And it was this continual tit for tat. So the only good thing was the fact that they weren't having a go at the security forces, i.e. the British Army and the police, but they're deeply vicious, horrible, and like the others, bigoted people.
If you hear of the Shankill Butchers, was that a group you knew of?
Yes, yeah. They were. They had quite a reputation because they were completely out of control. I think they were killing for the sake of killing in the end. I think various unionist sides had to sort of start eliminating their own gunmen because they were started killing anyone, be it their own side or what have you. But to think that that had gone on for so many years is horrendous. I don't quite know how people stood it out there, especially if they were in the areas where there was huge amounts of rioting and bombs going off and all this sort of thing.
Very lively. I suppose being in the situation you were in, you know, so restricted in your movements, you wouldn't have come in contact with the ordinary population so much. Is that right? You wouldn't...
Not socially, but, you know, speak to people going round the streets.
When you were on patrol, would that be? Yes.
Yeah, when the patrol was stood there and stopping the traffic, people would come up and saying, oh, what are you doing? Oh, writing about this lot.
Did you get an idea how the people were coping? the sort of lives they were leading?
Well, I think they were depressed because all their children were growing up to realise that this was normal. And one of the problems with the Republicans was the fact that if they wanted to make an attack on the security forces, say this patrol was going out in an armoured vehicle and they wanted to fire a rocket at that vehicle as it went between, you know, crossed a street, a side street, they'd fire a rocket which hit it, which would blow it up and kill all the people inside. They'd make use of all the children who thought it was a cool thing to do because the enemy is the British Army. Now, when I was young, in the mid-50s, all summer holidays I spend my entire time with a whole load of other children, boys and girls, playing either Germans and English or cowboys and Indians. And we killed each other all day long. But I didn't then go on and start, every time I met a German in the street, killed them or tried to maim them. There's a big difference, and they're brought up, they see this as normality. But they would employ these young kids as dickers. And what they would do is dick or spot the troops on patrol. So they were like spotters for the IRA, but they were known as dickers. So you'd be driving along and there'd be kids all up the street, and as they were getting closer, one would turn around and go, and the next one would get it. So they knew exactly where the patrol was going to be. So if the guy had his rocket on the end of a long, you know, electric wire, and as it was just about to come to the gap in the side street, you know, a kid would go, and the guy would know how to. And then I think they tried to make it an offence to spot for the IRA and took action against a couple of dickers, but it's a very difficult thing to improve. You know, so you couldn't trust any of them from that side of things. It's absolutely ridiculous state of affairs. And I went and saw a guy who was working in Londonderry. And he'd either been a Republican who'd been in prison, in the Mays prison, back in the 70s, or he'd had relatives killed. But he'd formed a peace group. And he and his fellow charitable workers used to get the Catholic children and the Protestant children together for events and such like. And they could see they had something in common rather than being enemies. But that he was running this in Londonderry. Now, if you're a nationalist, it was Londonderry. But if you're a Republican, it was Derry. You dropped the London. So you could get yourself in serious trouble. You went out into the Republican part of Londonderry and said, oh, it's very nice here in Londonderry. You'd be pounced upon. And there was a real divide there, which was like the city walls and a green area and a main road in front. And I can remember going out with a patrol one summer evening and just going up onto the walls to take a photograph, because you had a wonderful view looking out over Londonderry. In about 3 minutes, there was a huge menacing crowd on the edge of the Republican area, all shouting and threatening to riot because someone was taking photographs of their area. This is madness. You know, someone can't come along and take a photograph without a riot being started. But it was like that, you know, here, there and everywhere. Very, very difficult for the people.
Did you do any interviews, you know, with sort of leading personalities during your time in Northern Ireland? As long as you know, would there be any politicians you interviewed?
No. Because in the main, they wouldn't have been seen speaking to someone who is working for the mouthpiece of the propaganda rag, the British Army. Because the Sinn Féin had their own newspaper full of scurrilous tales. And every so often, they used to put something in there about Soldier magazine. So no politician in their right mind. Plus, you know, I'm in a security force base. I'm either on patrol or in the base. So there was never that that crossover. I was there purely to report the goings-on of the British Army, which is a shame. The nearest I got to a politician was flying from Luton Airport once to Belfast, and I sat in the lounge with Ian Paisley, who rang home in a very quiet voice. He just went, you know, literally where the light switch is, and I said, "Hello, dear. I'm catching the 6 o'clock plane, and I'll be home." When you think how his voice boomed, it's incredible. But you know, he was the only famous person I saw from Ireland, and that was in the airport waiting to fly across there.
How different was it, you know? And I suppose when you were there in 91, the peace process had started, I believe, hadn't it? You know, under the sort of table way.
Under the table, because yes. It was still all-out war at that stage.
Was it in 91? Mm. Yes. Not when so. Did things begin to, you know, give an indication that perhaps...
Well, over the next next couple of years, and I think around 93, it was getting fairly close to an understanding that, you know, there wouldn't be this trouble. And I think it was 94 when there'd been no coverage for some months of the workings of the British troops, because you couldn't report them doing anything to stop the IRA attacking people, because there wasn't a war, so therefore they couldn't be reported to be doing anything. I got a message from out there saying they'd like to go out and do the first story, post-conflict, if you like, of the British troops who were working in Northern Ireland. So I went out and visited the 1st Battalion of the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders. But it was very difficult because they were doing things, but they weren't doing things. You know, officially they were sitting in the barracks and not doing anything because there was no trouble to go on. But they still went out in support of the police, because the whole reason they were there was not to fight the IRA. The British Army was out there to provide support to the Royal Ulster Constabulary, who couldn't check traffic and carry out their normal police duties without being protected by the British Army, which is something that's got lost over the years. The Army wasn't there to fight terrorism, it was there to support the IUC. But in a peaceful situation, ostensibly, it was quite difficult. You know, they had the... The soldiers started taking their helmets off and wearing berets. And I think the IUC started wearing their peak caps and such like. But it was almost like a non-story. So it's very difficult to get something interesting out of it. You know, the new role of the army in Northern Ireland. Doing what they did before without any danger. But all the time, the Republicans were observing and planning, and you know, they got rid of their weapons, or they're still training their people, and they were able to better watch the movements of the police and security forces to identify any patterns of movement of vehicles and things like this. But I got a story out of it. And that spent quite some time at headquarters Northern Ireland being pored over by the political people to see whether there was anything that, couldn't be said. But I think I lost very, very few words from it.
I suppose it was a very sensitive issue then. Would it have been how the army
Yeah,
was
because it was really peace. But not even the outside media were allowed to have any contact with the British Army out there. So it really was, you know, exclusive story to see, you know, how it all worked out. And I think sometime after that they allowed the odd little story and then it got back to normal. But I think, you know, I went back a number of times after that before I left the magazine in 97. And they weren't doing much. Thousands of people not doing much. Because there was nothing to do and the police were starting to patrol by themselves without the need of the army to back them up.
What was the mood, though, in the army, you know, given the fact that the IRA were supposed to be disarming? Were they? Did they have any sort of faith in what Gerry Adams and the others were doing, or were they still suspicious, do you think?
Oh, I think they were still suspicious. But then I don't believe many people believe the political efforts of the British Parliament even. Yeah, they're just, to my mind, a lying, corrupt lot these days. I think there was, there's probably a lot of that going on then, which hasn't been reported.
And this, the big issue of the prisoners being allowed out. You know, I wondered, you were with the troops, what they thought of that. You know. People who'd done really murdered, hadn't they? And done all sorts
Murdered British soldiers in a lot of cases. Nice. I'm sure there's a lot of unhappiness over that, but there's nothing you can do about it. You know, the war is over, and it's only recently the government's decided that it wouldn't be workable to say to all these terrorists that are living elsewhere, come back and live in Northern Ireland, we won't take out any charges against you for murdering lots of people. But they've had to ditch that, so it's a very difficult situation to work in, you know, because it could antagonise one side. If you don't put out the olive branch to them, or if you do, and then when their murderers come back, you arrest them and imprison them, then they'll say, right, well, it's back to square one. So I suppose a lot of people have to sort of use a cliche, sit on their hands and keep their mouths shut while it's going on, and touch wood, there's reasonable peace, and has been for some time. Mm-hmm. But it's annoying when you see these bigots like Ian Paisley not wanting to, you know, get the Parliament, Irish Parliament, set up again for the sake of, you know, one thing. Have they got an international commission checking the handing in of IRA arms, then they should go by what the international commission says. Not saying no unless we see it ourselves, because it makes then the IRA look stupid, because they're kowtowing to the nationalists, if you like.
During your time there, one hears a lot about sort of crime, which is sort of perpetrated by the IRA and as well as the Protestant groups, the Unionist groups. And I've even heard stories of how they're in league together, the two sides, if you like, in organising crimes and drugs. Was there any evidence of that in your experience?
Yes. Yeah, there was a lot of cross-border smuggling, and indeed there's, in the last few months there was a big case about an Irish gentleman that owned a farm on the border in the national newspapers, because they arrested various people in England who were running a huge sort of estate of houses and shops and such like, which allegedly was the money he made from smuggling was building himself a property portfolio in the UK. But that still has to come to court. But, you know, I've seen that guy and I've seen where he operated. It just so happens that his farm sat astride the border. So, you know, he could go out in his front door in Northern Ireland and out his back door into the Irish Republic, which means you can move all sorts of things around. But and it was almost unsung, if you like, there were a lot of successes where the police would intercept lorries which were full of contraband drink or cigarettes, and indeed drugs, and the police arrests would be supported by the British Army, so they did used to pick up a lot of stuff. But no, it was absolutely rife, the smuggling, and there was probably an uneasy peace between the two sides, saying, well, you're making your money illegally by doing drugs and this, we're getting it done by smuggling cattle and bringing in cigarettes, let's not have a conflict, otherwise it might impact on our individual business empires, illegal as they may be. So let's not make waves, let's just carry on and make money.
During your time there, I imagine the early days, were the marches banned, these big marches that one hears of on the unionist side?
There was one particular era where suddenly every year there was a Protestant march trying to get through to march, and it meant it had to march through a Republican estate, and the Republicans would get annoyed, and then in the end the army was sent in to block the routes to the Unionist march, which in my mind was quite right. How provocative can you get, wanting to march with your banners and your drums through a Republican estate? You know, it's stupid, and they, of course, were demanding their right, and everyone's backed up in the fields in the July marching season. I always wanted to get out to do the Orange Parade, because unusually for a Catholic, I was born on Orangeman's Day, the 12th of July, which I think is probably the worst birthday a Catholic could have. But I never did get the opportunity to go out there. It was another reporter and photographer that went out on those occasions.
I was wondering also, you know, about the police in Northern Ireland. You were saying that the British Army, that the aim of it being there was to support the police, you know, and help them. Well, what was your opinion from what you saw? This would have been the RUC, would it?
Yeah, they had primacy.
How effective were they, do you reckon? Or
impartial? Oh, they were very, very effective. But they hadn't had the army to protect them. Sorry, support them. But both descriptions are completely correct. But if the army wasn't there to protect them, then lots of them would have been killed, because they couldn't operate. You couldn't go on and knock on the door somewhere and say, you know, can we come in? We understand, you know, your son's stealing a car. Well, they'd never get out alive, because the house would be surrounded by rioters and they'd be killed rather nastily. So literally everything was done with army support. So you'd have a couple of police Land Rovers and perhaps four or five army Land Rovers with a helicopter overhead as well, and another roads being sealed off by the army while the police did their ordinary job.
Over the time you were there, 91 to 97, did the composition of the RUC change?
And no, it's much yeah. the same.
Was it mainly unionist people? Did they manage to?
Well, there were some Catholics in it, but like all of these things, it was mostly Protestants.
The other thing I was going to ask you was, you know, the situation of the troops in Northern Ireland, and this, from what you've described so well, a very difficult and sort of their vulnerability was very great there. Do you think this had a bearing on how our troops behaved in the Gulf, the present Gulf situation, compared with, say, American and maybe some other forces as well?
Well, I think the British are used to. It's not peacekeeping like the UN peacekeeping, where you go in and physically stop a war going on. But in winning hearts and minds, then the British Army, because it's had a quarter of a century of troubles in Northern Ireland, then it probably led the world in dealing with these problem situations. And to begin with, Basra was quiet in the current Gulf War, but with all the shenanigans of the Americans killing anything that moves, and any car that goes near their convoys is machine gunned and the people killed, whether they're innocent or not. You know, what the British learnt in Northern Ireland has been used to great effect.
End of Reel 18, Laurie Manton.